Hello, DeFiers. Today, I'm bringing you a very special episode from a session I moderated at South by Southwest this year. South by is a huge festival annually held in Austin, Texas, that merges music, film, and tech. At South by, I had the opportunity of leading a session with Chris Dixon, a general partner at Andreessen Horowitz and the lead at A16C's massive crypto fund, where we discussed his recently published book, Read, Write, Own, Building the Next Era of the Internet. This book is an essential read for anyone looking to grasp the essence of Web3 and why blockchains and tokens will be at the core of the next phase of the internet. I'm excited for you to hear our conversation and dive into the insights that Chris shared. Let's dive in.
Hi, everyone. Hello. Welcome to the panel. This is Read, Write, Own, Building the Next Era of the Internet with Chris Dixon. He's been at Andreessen Horowitz since 2012. Founded A16C Crypto, has been leading it. It's one of the largest crypto funds. Previously, he founded two companies. Both were acquired. And I'm Camila Russo, the founder of The Defiant, the best source of information for Web3, and the author of The Infinite Machine, the first book on the history of Ethereum. So first off, definitely recommend Chris's book. I'm not just saying it because I'm in this panel. It's actually one of the best books explaining what Web3 is in very simple terms, and why it matters. So, if we can just start off by getting everyone on the same page, and if you can briefly summarize what the book is about.
Yeah, thank you, Camille. So I wanted to write a book. So I think most people are familiar with Bitcoin and maybe the sort of speculative aspects around tokens and blockchains. There's another side to the story, which is sort of the what I would call the productive side of blockchains, which I'm part of and a lot of entrepreneurs are part of. And I wanted to write a book that was for the general reader, you know, sort of without using tech jargon and sort of explaining things with examples and stories that made the case for the productive side of blockchains. And so so the book starts, the sort of first part of the book walks through the history of the internet and with a particular focus on sort of the sort of early modern internet in the 90s where I argue that it was an internet that was governed by systems that were democratically controlled, that were open. So this is, you know, the protocols like TCP/IP and HTTP for the web and email. And so most of when people connected to websites and creators and entrepreneurs, they did so directly. I believe that created that sort of this massive wave of innovation, of creativity in the 90s and 2000s. And then in the next section, I talk about the 2000s, which I was part of as an entrepreneur. People call that the Web 2 era. They also called it the read-write era. That's where the read-write comes from. This is a common term people would use to describe those two eras. And in that era, so sort of in the 90s, you had most of the websites that you used were kind of passive, like you would go and it was sort of like a brochure and you would read stuff and there was some clicking and submitting stuff, but for the most part, the 90s era was about consuming information and it sort of democratized the consumption of information, hence the term read era that sort of analogized to like a hard drive where you're reading the hard drive. And then in the 2000s, after the crash, like this is when I started my first company, it was sort of the Web 2 movement, the read-write movement. There were entrepreneurs who said, hey, the internet can be more than just this kind of consumption system. It can also democratize publishing. And so that was the beginning of blogging and social media. And of course, we all know today, you fast forward and, you know, everyone's on social media and posting. And so, you know, that dream was realized. And I think it had a lot of positive effects, including the fact that you now have 5 billion people who are sort of first-class participants in the internet and, you know, and use free services. And there's lots of good things about the technology industry. But my kind of core argument is that in that process, we also handed over control to a very small set of large companies who run these services. So today, the top 5 internet companies control something on the order of 95% of the money and the traffic on the internet. And I think we can talk more about artificial intelligence at some point, but I think artificial intelligence is very important and powerful, but is very likely to even further accelerate that consolidation. And then the next part of the book, I argue that blockchains provide a new way to create internet services that can help reverse that consolidation. Essentially you can create, you know, anything you can create using sort of a corporate model or a protocol model in the past eras, you can create using a blockchain model. And I argue that it kind of combines all of the societal benefits of the early protocol models of the 90s with a lot of the advanced modern functionality of corporate networks. And then in the last section of the book, I go through, because sometimes people say, like, what problems do blockchain solve? They sort of say be specific. So I go through 7 very specific areas: finance, social networking, games, AI, a bunch of different areas, and talk very specifically about services that exist or are being built using this blockchain model. And so the core argument is sort of a tour through the history of the internet with a lens, like a focus on sort of how power and money work on the internet, and how it became consolidated, and how I hope that we can sort of reverse that consolidation. And in the end, I'm trying to show this other side of the blockchain movement, the part that's, you know, if you've FTX and, you know, all the kind of speculation and meme coins that I think people are very familiar with. There's this other side that I'm part of, maybe some of you are part of, you know, tens of thousands of entrepreneurs are part of, and I felt like there wasn't a book that really kind of told their story.
Mm-hmm. I really liked this framing where you say that in Web 1, the key concept was the website.
Yeah.
Web 2, it was the post, yeah, like the blog post maybe. And then in Web 3, it's the token.
Mm-hmm.
Why do you think the cryptocurrency itself is so central to Web 3?
Yeah, so what you're alluding to, in software, there's a concept called encapsulation. And encapsulation is sort of this way of taking very complex things and making them simple. So, you know, you think about the original vision of the World Wide Web that Tim Berners-Lee had, and it was like, let's let anyone in the world upload information and connect it together, right? Like, that could become, without organizing principles, that could become this, you know, cacophonous mess, right? Like, it's very complicated. And so one of the many genius things that the designers of the web, like Tim Berners-Lee, did was create a simplifying concept, the website, right? And so the website was like, anyone can put up a website, and then you have links to other websites, and that's a way to make this really kind of big idea something that could be built with kind of Lego bricks building up.
Mm.
And so, as you said, like, I sort of view tokens as, so the key feature of the blockchain era, which is why the book's called Read, Write, Own, is the argument is we, I hope, are now entering this new era where digital ownership is sort of the key concept. We're democratizing digital ownership. And so the idea is that you now can build internet services where, for example, a user owns, if you use a service like Facebook or Twitter, I don't own C. Dixon at Twitter. Like, they can take it away from me, they can change the algorithm, they can change the economics. They can, if I don't like what something Twitter does, I can't leave without foregoing my audience. You know, in contrast to how it works with the web and email, if I don't like what my email provider's doing, I can switch and I can take my audience with me. And so in the blockchain model, you know, you can own, like, there's new social networks where you own your name and you own your audience. There's games where you can own the virtual goods that you can create virtual goods and sell them to other people. And it's a peer-to-peer economy instead of a sort of a centralized planned economy. And there's a whole kind of wave of new internet services where ownership is a key concept. Now, just like with the web, that can get really complicated and messy. And so what a token is a simplifying concept in the way a website was a simplifying concept. It's like a token I think of as it's a unit of ownership. Often people think of tokens, they think of Bitcoin, you know, they call them coins, we call them tokens, but it's all the same kind of coins, tokens, whatever you want to call them. But, you know, they think of Bitcoin like money, they think of NFTs like pictures, but really it's important to not confuse the technology in its essence with particular uses of the technology. Just like early websites were mostly passive, and, you know, I don't know if you go back in the Internet Archive, you'll see all this funny, you know, it was like these crazy fonts and whatever, and they're very simple, you know, but of course a website can, as we've seen today, can be much more. They can be AI powered, they can be, you know, social media, they can be all these other things. In the same way, I think a lot of people have overgeneralized on some early examples of tokens and not appreciated the expressivity and generality of the concept and the technology.
Yeah, I really liked that framing. You know, I've been involved in crypto since 2013, and I think for the first time, that really changed the way I think about tokens, because I think most people, when you think token or crypto, in your head you see like a coin, like a physical coin. And so I think that kind of limits your perspective on what a token actually is and can do. But you argue in your book, no, like a token is actually a package of information.
Sure.
And so it gives it, you know, it just provides flexibility to builders, holders of these tokens to, you know, what the things that they can accomplish with this technology.
Yeah, well, thank you. And I'm glad that they came through, because I tried, for all of you, if you're thinking about reading the book, I've tried very, very hard. I spent a long, long time to make it, you know, as clear as possible and accessible, because I really don't want this, I really wanted this to be a book that people understood. And actually, I've been really encouraged so far that I've heard a lot of feedback that people say that, you know, crypto folks will give it to their friends and their family members, and they say, I feel like I finally understand this. So hopefully that came through, and thank you. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I would say, I mean, it's in some ways it's funny, like, because crypto started with Bitcoin and financial things, I think it's so, like, sometimes I wish it had started with, you know, so, like, the things I described, like social networks or creative things, because now it's, you know, it's sort of now so branded as financial, and I think that's also created a lot of the controversy and the regulatory challenges, you know, because finance is heavily regulated, but it's really, that's just sort of an accident of history. I think about like social media, you know, early on, like I was on Twitter, I don't know, in the mid 2000s. And at the time, you know, it was like South by Southwest, and you were like, hey, I'm going to get a taco or whatever. Right. And like, it got kind of dismissed by a lot of people as, you know, literally like kind of nerds saying what they're going to have for lunch. Right. Now, of course, if you abstracted it and you step back, you'd say, well, this is really just a way to share things with a follower list. Right. It's really a communications protocol. And so, you know, why wouldn't it someday be used by politicians and by, you know, business leaders and so forth, right? And so I just think it's important to, you know, and like early open source software, you know, it started at MIT, Richard Stallman in the 80s, and it was like this very kind of, you know, politicized kind of thing. And then I think a lot of people underestimated it in the 90s, like when it kind of, I think of it as morphing in the 90s into a real technology movement with things like Linux. And that, because they were so kind of, you know, it had been so branded around this, like these crazy, you know, anti-property rights people or something. You know, I'm not saying they're crazy, but that's what the quote in quotes. Mm-hmm. But because of that, people kind of, you know, dismissed it or underestimated it. And I believe the same thing is happening here, because they see, you know, it's the silly, it's like the avatars and maybe Bitcoin or whatever, things that they maybe may or may not agree with. And so they're seeing it in a more limited scope than it really can be. And look, as a investor and just someone who's excited about innovation, I get really excited by this, because it's like, this is a new like computing primitive, and like, look at all these cool things. You know, every day somebody comes in and they have some new idea, and it's just very creative and fun and interesting to me to see, you know, that how people are going to take this new concept and evolve it.
But of course, like, I understand that argument, but in the end, blockchains were made to transfer value. So, you know, the financial aspect, the money aspect is at the very core of this technology. And if you are introducing tokens into everyday, you know, interactions on the web, you risk kind of financializing our everyday interactions. And with the very early experiments in blockchain-based social media, we've already kind of seen that, like, Friendtech was this, like, version of Twitter, but it was all about trading names, like, trading usernames. And, you know, it kind of brought a speculative aspect to social media, which was really interesting, but I don't know if that's kind of what mainstream, you know, users want from social media, or if that even is good for humanity. Like, do we want like finance to be a part of everyday interactions?
Yeah, so I have this in the book. I have a section called The Computer Versus the Casino. Mm-hmm. And the idea is that there, I believe there have been two cultures that have formed around blockchains. And there's one culture I call the casino, which is people that are primarily interested in trading and speculation. And you know, many of that is, much of that is innocuous. It's like meme coins and whatever. Like they're, you know, like that's, if they want to do that, that's I guess what they can do. But some of it is not, like, you know, FTX and other kinds of, you know, catastrophic events, I think came out of that culture. There's another side to it, which is this kind of, what I believe is sort of more of blockchains. I see blockchains as computers in the sense that you write code for them and they run code and they have different properties like computers. You know, it's a different kind of computer. It runs on a network of computers, but it's a computer. And I believe it can be used in productive ways. So I see myself on the kind of computer side of the thing, of the divide. The reason I put that in the book and I've talked about that is I do believe that that culture you're describing, I think has had a negative impact on both the world and on this movement. Mm. I think it has given it a bad name. I think it is destructive. I think it needs to be reined in. Our firm has been very clear about that, and we've also pushed for like policy solutions that do that, that put guardrails around it. I would kind of liken it to, like I sort of analogize it to home ownership. Okay, so like why is home ownership? I think we generally believe that owning a home is the fact that we allow home ownership is good, is generally a positive thing, right? Like if owning a home has psychological benefits, you can raise a family in your home. I think it aligns, you know, there's a lot of data that shows that people that own homes take better care of their homes, take better care of their communities. As a byproduct of owning homes, you have markets. You have people trading homes, flipping homes. But it's a byproduct, right? It's secondary. In the same way, like the stock market, like the point of the stock market, the societal benefit of the stock market, it's an efficient way to allocate capital to companies that are building useful products. Like that's the point of it. As a byproduct, we have hedge funds and trading. And I'm not saying hedge funds and trading are bad. Like they provide, like it's the fact that you can, you know, look on your phone and see Apple's stock price. Like they provide liquidity and price discovery. And I think generally as society, we've agreed that markets have a role, but they shouldn't be the focal point. Mm-hmm. And that's the problem in the blockchain world. So I think they have to exist. They should have guardrails around them. But the focal point should be returning power to participants in these internet services, the users, the creative people, the entrepreneurs, the software developers who use these services. And so, you know, like a big part of the argument in my book is around economics. So, you know, in the web and, in, you know, say, for example, you build a website and you build an audience on your website and you decide you want to charge money or run ads, you, the website owner, keep all of that money, right? So in the internet vernacular, we'd say there are no take rates. Take rates is sort of the toll that the gatekeeper charges. In modern internet services, there are take rates, and I have a whole chapter in the book going through this in detail, but like, you know, Facebook and Twitter have 100% take rates. They, you know, the top five social networks made $150 billion in revenue last year, and they have these little creator programs that are sub 1% of revenue that are immaterial, but outside of that, they kept all of the money, right? Apple, anyone who's in, like, it's a big deal in the software world, they take 30%, Android takes 30%. That's over 10 times, you know, that's for payments. That's over 10 times what credit cards charge. And so you have these big gatekeepers and they take all the money. And so by allowing, you know, a creator to own their audience and have a direct, so that's what the ownership is about, letting users own their names, their audiences, letting software developers have predictable APIs, building services that are predictable and respect ownership. As a byproduct, you will have that trading stuff, but I think it should never be the focus. And I agree with you, like a lot of the stuff so far that's happened in this world has, you know, not a decent amount has had, I'd say sort of has been overly financialized. And I think that's generally had a negative effect and you know, it's one of the things that with the book and all the stuff we do, we're trying to kind of counteract.
So we've been talking about kind of the potential of what blockchain technology tokens can do. What are the main ways that crypto is being used right now?
Yeah, so I'd say a couple things. So one, I think there's certain applications that are bigger than people realize. So like stable coins is a good example. So stable coins are tokens that represent things like the US dollar. There's one called USDC, there's one called Tether. And you know, there's many, like I think last month there were $600 billion with a B dollars in stablecoin transactions last year. A lot of that doesn't happen in the U.S. Because it's like in the developing world where access to the dollar is not always easy, and that and so I think that, for example, I think a lot of people like talked about Bitcoin doing payments like 10 years ago, and it didn't really work, and then people kind of wrote off crypto as a kind of a payment system. But I think that's actually something that's growing quite a lot. Like, creators, selling like digital collectibles like NFTs to their audiences. Like, even you'll hear that NFTs are dead, but like last year there were $8.6 billion in NFT sales. So, still quite significant. And then if you look at the stats, like, the hundreds of millions of people have own tokens and crypto and things. A lot of those are probably passive financial kind of oriented people, but there are something on the order of 30 million, active Ethereum users that are using these services if you look at the data from the wallet providers. There's a big wave of new startups, some of which we're investors in, building social networks and games and financial services and things, involving artificial intelligence and just sort of the whole kind of range of internet services that we hope will grow. 30 million is a lot of people, but it's actually, the internet's now 5 billion. So, we haven't had, what I think of as sort of the iPhone moment or the ChatGPT moment, where the technology has really kind of shown its full potential and gone mainstream. It's definitely not. But obviously the reason I do this is I think it will at some point. If you kind of go back and look at the history of computing movements, they all have kind of two phases. They have sort of an incubation phase and then a growth phase. So, going back to, the advent of computing in World War II, mainframe computers, mini computers, PCs, internet, mobile phones, there were people, there's a great documentary on General Magic. It was a company that tried to build basically the iPhone in early 90s. And it just turned out it was too early. They didn't have, the semiconductors and the screens and the batteries and all that kind of stuff wasn't there yet. So it took another 15 years. AI, first neural network paper was 1943. There was actually an AI financial bubble in the 80s, Expert Systems, you can go read about. There was like AI veterans, we'll talk about summers and winters and like decades of funding and not funding. And then eventually, it's interesting with AI, right? Why did it happen? It happened probably because of video games, which then basically funded GPU development, and then you had GPUs get much better, and now you can run, much larger neural networks, and then the systems become much more effective. So I believe we're following kind of a similar trajectory where there's like, you're building out the infrastructure, you're building out the applications, you've got millions of early enthusiasts, but have not yet kind of really broken out. I hope that is something in the near future.
Yeah, because I think an argument a lot of people or maybe skeptics make is that, Bitcoin has been around since 2008, and Ethereum since 2015, and the fact that we haven't seen a mainstream crypto app yet is a signal that this thing isn't really useful for anything, other than maybe speculating. Yeah. But the point is that you're making is all of the other world-changing technologies have taken longer to mature.
I mean, like, I've been doing internet stuff for 25 years. I've heard this my entire career. I heard this about the internet. I heard it about social media. I heard it about mobile computing. I had friends who quit mobile. I literally had an entrepreneur friend who quit. It was like iPhone was 2007. I think he quit in 2006 because of 10 years. And like, so this is just, it's just that no one was really paying attention to mobile computing back then. I mean, the tech world is gotten bigger, it's more prominent. Like with crypto, you have the prices and all these other things that draw media attention. But if you actually go look at these things, some of which I was part of, many of which I talk about, by the way, in detail in the book, in the history of these computing movements, and if you go read about them, the things, they all had these kind of build-up periods. These things don't just kind of, they're not immaculately conceived. You have to build all sorts of infrastructure and other kinds of, pieces that are required. Some of it is sort of this kind of Moore's Law type stuff where you just pack more transistors and you could kind of predict, like, obviously Steve Jobs is the incredible genius, but I think to some extent if you looked at the kind of trends of modems and chips and batteries and you'd say between 2006 and 10 probably you could make a really interesting mobile device. Like, a lot of this stuff is determined by the infrastructure, and blockchains have their own kind of, it's not Moore's law, it's not like transistors packed on a chip, but you do have this very steady improvement in security, cost, performance, usability, you know. So you said like, so like Bitcoin was a very specific application. Ethereum in 2015 generalized Bitcoin, and sort of that would liken it to sort of, you know, you took what was a specific app and made it into a general computer. You can write any kind of application for Ethereum. It's a programmable computer. Sort of like analogy would be like you kind of now have an app store. You can write apps for it. But then, you know, for, I'm sure you know this, people are in it, like it had a lot of limits. Mm-hmm. And there's a whole kind of story as to like how people have been improving those limits. And so I think that's an important part, the infrastructure. And then an important part is, you know, just the right entrepreneurs building the right things. And so, you know, I just think these things take some time.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
This is important. Solana is having their largest community conference called Solana Crossroads in less than a month. There will be over 3,000 plus attendees coming to Istanbul. Speakers include Anatoly Yakovenko, Raul Paul, Ansem, and basically everyone you'd want to see from the Solana ecosystem. From what I understand, tickets are almost sold out, so be sure to check the link in the description. Ready to dive into the world of on-chain derivatives? Syn Futures is your decentralized portal to trading futures and perps with up to 100x leverage. Now live on Blast Mainnet, Syn Futures V3 combines limit orders and concentrated liquidity into a single unified liquidity model dubbed Oyster AMM, offering unparalleled capital efficiency. Earn triple airdrop rewards through an incentive program designed around Blast and Syn Futures points. And join the new Trading Grand Prix competition to win a piece of the $500,000 prize pool. Visit synfutures.com to start your decentralized trading journey today. That's synfutures.com.
The vision for the own era of a user-owned internet with predictable rules, with kind of a democratic style of governance is great. It's super inspiring. But so far, and you know, we've already established that it's very early. But so far, it's not playing out exactly that way. So you know, we're seeing that. Token-based governance is leading to plutocracies, right? It's like people who have the most tokens are the ones who are controlling these protocols. There's also the ability to change the rules of the game. If you have communities around protocols or blockchain applications, they can coordinate to change the rules, and that's happened before. So do you think, you know, are these problems that are growing pains and will be solved down the line? Or maybe these are just things that we need to live with, and they're just, even if they stick around, they're preferable to Web2 style problems.
Yeah, so you talk, so there's this whole topic, and I have a chapter on network governance. So this is the question of how do you, you know, so rewind to like the World Wide Web. So the World Wide Web, there was no one in charge of the World Wide Web. It was a community of software developers and nonprofits and service providers, and people would propose standards and things, but it really required the community to decide. They sort of voted, so to speak, based on what software they used and things like that. Open source software also works in a similar way. You know, sometimes you have like a leader like Linus or something, but often it's sort of a group of people and they're coming together. And those systems, like, I think those are just like the real world democracy, those systems are messy, right? Mm-hmm. Like they're not, like they're sort of designed to be messy. You know, the main internet services we use today, you know, Facebook, Google, Twitter, et cetera, they're, you know, effectively monarchies, or, you know, they're controlled by one person. I mean, there's, you know, CEO, and maybe there's a product team or something that decides things. And you know, I would argue that these systems, you know, maybe 10 years ago that made sense when they were just like a social network, but now that we realize how important these things are, that they control global business, culture, politics, mm-hmm. that like maybe we should rethink how they're governed. And maybe it shouldn't matter, like, do you like Elon Musk or not? Like, it shouldn't matter, in my opinion, mm-hmm. because it shouldn't be that something so central, like the internet's town square, is dependent on who happened to pay more money for the thing, right? It should be, like, this is core, it's sort of like, it'd be like if AT&T decided who got to make phone calls. Like, it just doesn't make sense that this technology provider who's good at infrastructure or, you know, products or whatever, also gets to control these things, I think. The economics, the algorithms. So I think a better way to do it is through something more democratic, the way that these early protocols worked. And that's what blockchains, you know, allow you to do. And what blockchains allow you to do, because of the way blockchains work, it basically lets you encode governance rules in software. And so you can try out different governance systems. And so there's a lot of interesting experimentation going on. We have a guy named Andy Hall, who's a professor at Stanford in the political science department, who works with us, who studies these things, and he's like on cloud nine because it's like there's like 15 different experiments going on. He gets to study them in a way that like he couldn't study them before. But to your point, like it's messy, and there's like definitely, you know, there's DAOs and things where there's like, you know, chaos and mess and everything else. I think there's good examples. Like I think some things like Uniswap is a DAO, you know, it's mm-hmm. controlled by a DAO, it's a protocol, and I think it's working reasonably well, and I think there's positive cases, and I think it will take time. It's like I open that chapter, that section of the book with the great Winston Churchill quote, the only thing worse than democracy is everything else, right, is every other system, because it's like sort of like, yeah, it's not perfect, but it's probably better than having one person decide and control major, you know, communication protocols.
I think, you know, that's my view too. I become admittedly a bit jaded from, you know, covering this every day and like seeing everything that can go wrong. But even with, you know, centralized token votes, at least it's a group of people who own the token, who, you know, have access to a transparent form of ideas. And, you know, that's, even if it's centralized around token holders, it's still better than, you know, having a single person decide.
I think also, you know, look, everything in the blockchain world is open source code, everything. Bitcoin, you know, Ethereum, the governance systems. I think also just having it be open, like you know what the rules are. Mm-hmm. You can decide, you can choose. You can say, I think those are good rules or bad rules. Think about how the governance of, you know, Google and Twitter work. It's like you have no idea, and they mm-hmm. have these 80-page terms of service, and I just got an update from PayPal. They changed my terms of service. Did I get to read that? Do I negotiate that? Like, am I supposed to hire a lawyer? Like, it's just a crazy system that we have today as to how these systems, they handle my data and how they govern them. And so, I think just the fact that it's open source code, that it's that it's attempting to be democratic, that there's, you know, it's messy, but I think it's just, to me, it's clearly a better way to do it, or at least to go down that road. Mm-hmm. And the other thing I would say is, look, I mean, like, we're early, like, we're 30 years into the internet. Like, I think that's early for invention of this magnitude. And now that we now see how important it is in a way that I don't think we did 10 years ago, these systems, like social networks. Mm-hmm. And I think, I would argue that, like, even if you disagree with maybe you hate blockchains, you know, whatever, like, fine, but, like, don't you think it's time that we think about how these systems are governed in a way that's not just, like, the five people that own them control them and get to control all the economics and all of the, you know, algorithms? And, like, I'm a little surprised that's not a more common debate that's going on of, like, you know, why did we hand all this control to these five companies?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it's worth thinking about these the way that we access the web as kind of utilities, right? Like you mentioned, AT&T. They're such an important part of our daily lives that I agree. It doesn't make sense to have very kind of concentrated power deciding how those systems, those utilities work. But you know, some of these, and we're seeing this already, some of these applications are already gaining network effects, getting big enough to kind of command most users, most liquidity. You mentioned Uniswap is a great example of that. What about the risk that they get so big that they hold enough power to become essentially kind of, you know, like corporations, where they can just like change the rules and, you know, Uniswap changed its, as you obviously know, its license to a business license. So it's like it's open source, but also like nobody can actually compete after or like before, I think it's like 5 years. So they've set up some kind of guardrails to prevent competition. So we're already seeing signs of kind of a corporatization of a protocol.
Yeah, I mean, look, the key, so, this, you know, the, so like what, why, so what is a blockchain? It's a, it's a computer that's built on a network of virtual computers that has the specific character. I call them computers that can make commitments. Mm-hmm. And I explain that in detail in the book. But the idea is that with the blockchain, so for example, Bitcoin commits that there will only ever be 21 million Bitcoins. It commits that you can't double spend a Bitcoin. It makes various commitments that are necessary but not sufficient conditions for Bitcoins to have value, right? But like, it wouldn't, people wouldn't want, you know, people who like Bitcoin like the fact that it's committed in the code, right? It's, it can't change. Mm-hmm. I like to say, you know, Google's original motto was don't be evil. I think you could debate whether they've kept to that motto. I don't think they have. I like to say blockchains, instead of don't be evil, it's can't be evil. You bake into the code what the rules are, okay? And so with Ethereum, you can build a social network, you can build Uniswap, you can build whatever, you can build a system, and it's baked into the code, it's open source code, what the rules are, and if you build it, by the way, you can build bad blockchains, you can build good ones. If you build it right, you build it in such a way that those rules cannot change or can't change without a majority of the community or some other kind of, some kind of checks and balances. And so, I mean, that's sort of the core novel feature of blockchains, is that you can make long-term commitments like that. And that means that users and software developers and creative people, people that, you know, build on top of these systems, can rely on those assurances, right? They can rely on those assurances and they can build a business, they can, you know, trust it. And so, look, that can be, you know, they're good, just like anything in the world, like people can do this correctly or incorrectly, but done correctly, a blockchain system can make long-term commitments in a way that that these corporate systems can't. One thing I might mention is, I argue that in the book that all of these companies, these internet companies, have followed a predictable pattern, which is they start off, like you think about an early Facebook or something, it's trying to get users, it's trying to get media companies, it's trying to get content, and they go out and they solicit that, and they're really friendly, and they have open APIs. And then over time, you know, as they grow, you know, of course, so they start off, every technology follows an S-curve, it's kind of starting off, and then it, hopefully it hits the kind of growth period, and then at some point, they kind of level off, because they saturate the world, there's only so many people. And when they get to that point, what we've seen over and over again is they suddenly change their approach to the people that use that network, right? So, ask media companies. It's like a very different world 10 years ago, you know, or 15 years ago, how these social networks treated them. They wanted their content, mm-hmm. and now they don't want their content, right? Or they want to make the very restrictive rules or, you know, bad economics or whatever it might be. And so these basically, they it feels a lot to, like, especially to content maker, like creative people, software developers for sure. There was a famous thing that happened in 2011-12 where, you know, so people forget this, but like original Twitter didn't even have an application. It was all third-party application developers. There were hundreds of Twitter startups, people building applications, analytics services, like, you know, all sorts of, so there was a whole ecosystem around it. They, but then in 2000, I think it was 12, they basically bought one of the clients and made their own app and then effectively shut down their API. Facebook did the same thing. So software developers were like massively burned by these services. And so you just have, I argue, this is not because these are bad people running the companies. I think they're well-intentioned, but it's just the nature of having a company that can change its rules, control networks, that over time, their incentives change. And so it's very important, I think, if we're gonna build a new generation of internet services and people are gonna depend on those services, to architect them in a way that they can't kind of bait and switch you, that they can make these commitments. That's why computers that make commitments are so important now, because you can now build a new wave of internet services where you can actually keep your promises. Now, to your point, it can be done badly or it can be done well, and that's, you know, like any computer system, you can make good or bad systems, but well-designed blockchains can't be evil. They persist in their rules.
And the fact that they're open also allows more competition. Like right now, you know, you can't just go up and leave Google or Facebook without losing everything.
Well, and so like, and that's very important. Like, so So for example, like look at email. Like why have so many journalists moved to Substack, right? Because Substack only charges 10%, right? So on Twitter, if you build an audience, this and that, like you basically at this point, like, you know, Twitter makes a lot of money and they don't share it with you. And so what you try to do is you try to get people to go over your Substack and then you can have them subscribe and you can, they only take 10%. Why do they only take 10%? Is it because they're especially nice? No, because email, you can switch, right? If they charge more than 10%, you own your email list and you can switch to MailChimp, right? And so like, it's the fact that you can, and same with web hosting providers. Like if you host your website at Squarespace or whatever, you know, AWS, if they start doing extractive things or trying to mess with you or charge too much, you could just take your website and move it, right? So like early protocol networks on the internet, because you have your own domain name, because you own your audience, you could switch. And what that meant is it really transformed the economics because they can only charge so much. They can, and I go through this sort of systematically in the book, but all of the kind of things built on email and the web, they all charge much, much lower take rates, right? Once you lock people in, like Facebook and Twitter, you're locked in. If you build an audience of a million people and you leave, you lose that million people. And so you're stuck there, right? And you hear this again and again if you go talk to like TikTok creators or whatever, you know, like this is why they're all like selling body spray and doing sponsorship because they can't make money on the platform and they're locked in. And so they're trying to do all these gymnastics to make money because they can't make money on the internet. By the way, musicians, same thing. I just saw like Snoop Dogg had a video. He had, it was a billion streams and he made 40 grand or something. Like Spotify's own numbers is like only 15,000 artists make $50,000 a year more, I believe that's, or under 20,000. Right. Like, you don't make money on these platforms. They take they essentially take almost all the money. And so people are doing all of these kind of side channel things, merchandise offline and sponsorships, right? But that doesn't, but on email, on the web, you can have a, that's why there's millions every day. There's a new, you know, website funded and things. And so you want to create the conditions under which you encourage entrepreneurship and creativity, right? And I don't think we're doing that with these current dominant systems.
Yeah, so email and the web, the reason why that happens is because they're the two open protocols that, you know, haven't been closed off by corporations. And then you're kind of, what you're calling for is, imagine if the entire internet, like all of the internet applications, were ruled by protocols, and not only that, but with protocols that have this integrated business model, right? This like token that allows builders to actually sustain this system. Because I mean, the problem with open source protocols is they're really hard to maintain. Like there's no incentive there. But if you had a token there, then that becomes easier.
Yeah.
I think let's open. There's a bunch of questions, so I want to leave time for that. Let's see. Do you think that protecting content from AI by using blockchain could be a killer use case for the technology, from things like deepfakes and content theft?
Yeah, I mean, so the you know, obviously the stuff happening in AI is amazing. It's the, you know, and I'm sure everyone here has tried it, like you can now create, you know, amazing images, text, soon it looks like, you know, really great video, you can replicate voices. Up until now, we've kind of relied on, you know, when you get an email, you're supposed to kind of look, read the email and say, does this look fake, or kind of look at the headers or something. And you know, the voice doesn't sound right, or the video looks fake, or something like this. That's not going to work anymore, right? And so the question in that world is, how do we still trust the internet? Like, how do we know this video is real? My argument would be, you know, you need some system for authenticating, is that a real person? You need some system for authenticating, is that a real video? And I believe when you need a system like that, it will get built. The question is, will it get built by Facebook, or will it get built but in a way that's you know, owned by the internet community, for example, on a blockchain. Like a blockchain, one way to look at a blockchain, it's a community-owned database. And blockchains are very good at having at recording the provenance of a piece of media, for example, or, you know, having an audit trail for where something came from. And there's systems, you know, we have investments in companies that do things that, like, it's like proof of personhood, prove I'm Chris Dixon, prove I'm a real person, I'm not a robot. Prove, you know, attest that this video came from the New York Times, right? So I do think that's a super interesting area. I would, with respect to kind of blockchains and AI, another thing I would mention is, with respect to AI, is that there's been kind of an implicit covenant on the internet, between sort of distribution and content on the internet. So distribution meaning search engines and social networks. So if you're a content site, you know, you're the New York Times, you basically say to Google, you can crawl my website and you can use snippets in your search results, but in exchange, I expect you to send me some amount of traffic, right? Mm-hmm. That's not an explicit, it's sometimes explicit, but generally it's not explicit, but it's this thing that's emerged over 30 years. It's sort of how the business model of the internet works, right? If you, that's how anything who's not one of these top five sites, who's just like a website, that's how they sustain themselves, right? Is that you get traffic and you'll just go, you know, I've been involved with these companies and actually one of the worst things that can happen, if you know what one boxing is, when Google decides to take, like they do this with lyrics and Wikipedia, they decide to just take the content and put it at the top of the site and then kind of demote the link and you get much less traffic. So now AI systems like ChatGPT, these things are amazing, but it's probably only a few years away before you go to a search engine / AI system and you say, you know, what restaurant should I go to? And it just tells you the restaurants and there's no need to click through, right? In that world, what happens to all of these, you know, the entire rest of the internet, basically, that depends on that traffic? Like, I don't think people have really thought that through. Like, that's, so, you know, like, that's when I say, like, AI is going to confer, like, you know, concentrate the internet. And you know, what's happened, too, like, I used to be on the board of Stack Overflow, which is a programmer community Q&A website. And, you know, so it's a place where you go ask programming questions and things. And they got most of their traffic through Google. People go to Google and search for stuff. That was one of the main training sources for these AI systems was Stack Overflow and GitHub. Mm. And that was fine. That was consistent with their license. But as a result, that then got put in the AI system. And now the latest data, I'm not involved, the company got sold, but the latest data I've seen is that the Stack Overflow traffic is dramatically down because people don't need to use it anymore. So you sort of have this thing where the data is going in and these systems are getting really good, but then they no longer sort of eating their seed corn. Like they don't need, you know, like where does the new data come from? And like there's, what's happening now is they're saying, okay, we need new data. We'll go to these offshore content farms and we'll produce that data. And so I think if we don't think it through, we're headed to a world where there's like five websites, you go and you get an answer, and any new data they need is created in some like content farm. And websites just kind of don't have a business model anymore, right? And like, I don't think that's a good outcome. I'm not saying this is like some nefarious plan, I just don't think people have really thought through like step one, two, three of like what this is gonna do in terms of the incentives and economics. And so, like with that, for example, I think it becomes more important than ever that we think about new business models for the people, like the content creators and creative people, and a whole bunch of what we're doing. I'll give you like one example, like one idea. A whole bunch of what we're doing is exactly that: is trying to think about new incentive systems and ways that, for example, creators could get together and kind of collectively bargain with these AI systems, put their content together in a repository, and set the terms at which the AI system could use it. You have other things like one I think really cool idea is what's called collaborative storytelling, which is this idea that you could get a whole bunch of people together and they could come up with kind of to co-develop the next narrative universe, like the next Star Wars or Harry Potter, and like in the same way that a community creates Wikipedia, a community can create stories and universes, and they can get rewarded with tokens as in proportion to their contribution to that story, and then those stories can be licensed for movies and other kinds of things. And so there's just like a whole rich kind of area where, in a world where content production costs go to zero, which looks like what AI will do, what are other business models that you can create for all of these people who currently depend on that as a business? Like, I think that will become more and more urgent as AI proliferates.
I mean, it's very uncertain, and it's, for me as a media company owner, it's terrifying to think what can happen if, you know, like suddenly we get no traffic from Google. And yeah, I guess like the new business models that will arise or succeed from this will be ones that where content creators, like news websites, have a direct relationship with their audiences. We're not
that, or they should pay you, right? I mean, the AI system should, if they use your content, why aren't you getting paid, is my view. Like, they're paying, if you just saw it, like Reddit just did a deal with Google, they're getting paid, but the top of the power law, the top of the pyramid will get paid, but what about everybody else? Like, they should either pay you or you, there need to be new business models. But like the this idea that they're just going to suck all the content and not pay anybody, like I don't think it's a good outcome for, obviously it's not for you and like, and for a lot of other, you know, small businesses. By the way, I mean, like, we're in the business of investing in small businesses and startups and things. I don't think it's good for them. It's in our, you know, that's one reason that we care about this topic, is it's just not good for, you know, like, I would like to see, I think both as a citizen, but also as an investor, an internet that's dynamic, where there's lots of startups, lots of creative people, an internet with five big companies, five big AI systems with offshore data centers and this and that, I think is just sort of a little bit dystopian, frankly, but also just probably will really hurt innovation and startup formation.
Okay, we've only gone through one question and we have like eight
Sorry.
More. Let's see. What's the risk in proof of stake blockchains being dominated by one or two large token holders versus it really being community governed?
Yeah, well, this is getting in the weeds. These are, I guess these are real crypto people asking questions. Yeah, look, I mean, so the way blockchains work generally is that they have kind of, they give you assurances that, just sort of game theoretic assurances that as long as sort of all of the, like in the case of Bitcoin, the miners, in the case of a proof of stake system, like the validators, as long as they all don't collude, the system will continue operating as designed, the computers will keep their commitments, but there are failure cases. In Bitcoin, it's called 51% attacks, where 51% of the miners all collude. In proof of stake systems like Ethereum, there's potential for collusion. It's never happened in any large scale blockchain. Like there's never been an incident like that. And you know, a lot of people working hard to make sure the incentives are such that they don't happen. But like that's a, you know, it's something one should think about. I don't think it's a likely risk, but it's certainly something we should all be, you know, in the community should be aware of and track.
Yeah, and then I think the last question probably, in your example of owning your Twitter profile, so it can't be taken away, doesn't that imply liability for costs? Do you think the average person wants that?
Liability for costs, so like having to pay for it? Is that, well, so I think, I mean, the key point here is that I think the average person, I think a couple things. Like I think that certainly the people who make their living on social networks, which is a lot of people and an increasing number of people, because I think the line between kind of creators and users is blurring and more people are becoming kind of micro-influencers and things. Certainly, I think those people who do that care about the economics of the system. They care about the fact that, you know, how much money they can make. And the way these current systems are architected, because they lock you in, because once you build an audience, you can't leave, they have all the control of the economics, okay? So I'm not saying that the average person is gonna say, I'm choosing the social network because I have, you know, can switch, but they will choose the social network where they have better economics. I think people definitely, especially in their business, care about money. And I'm saying that the economics of the system are a consequence of the architecture, like kind of the kind of core argument is that the design of these systems ends up having these downstream cascading consequences on things people actually care about, like their economics and their choices they have and what software they use and things like that. Mm-hmm. So I'm not saying they're all sitting there thinking about internet architecture, but I am thinking they're, you know, in the same way that journalists all are moving to Substack because it's 10%, it's not 100% take rate. Like, that matters to people, and that's a consequence of the architecture.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think maybe clarify that, like, owning your Twitter username doesn't mean that you are paying for, like, Twitter's cost. Like, it's you're like the owner of your username, and like if you own like the blockchain version of Twitter token, maybe it's like you indirectly own a hardware protocol, but that doesn't mean that you are you're paying for, like,
there's all sorts
the
of different
upkeep of it.
Yeah, I mean, so like that's actually another part that I've talked about in the book. But a lot of these systems, like Twitter, subsidize the hosting costs and things like that. And I think in a lot of these blockchain-based systems, that's where they're moving towards. So I agree that if they're saying that like people aren't going to want to pay for social networking, that's probably true. And I think you're going to see already seeing a wave of blockchain-based social networks where you don't pay for it and it's free and it's sort of feature parity, but has these other properties that make them more attractive.
Great. And then how do you think CBDCs might impact blockchain adoption across the globe?
Yeah, so CBDCs, for those who don't know, that's central bank digital currencies. It can mean different things to different people, but like sometimes it's referred to as sort of like a, like it's kind of, so there's sort of USDC and stable coins, and these are like things that represent the dollar that exists on a blockchain. They're regulated, and there's a stablecoin bill in front of Congress that would further regulate them, which is a good thing. They need like good guardrails around them. There's another proposal where the government, like the U.S. government, would actually create the system, like the blockchain, or the maybe not blockchain, but like literally like write the software and have full control. And I think I believe that's going to be a big political issue in the next 5 years. It's already becoming a political issue because. And I'm not taking a side on the political issue, but the question is: should the government have that much control? Because should the government be able to decide who gets access to money? You know, like in China, they have a social credit score; the government tracks it. Like, is it sort of a stepping stone to sort of full surveillance and control? And there's people that think that's, you know, too much power to give to the government. So it's a hot topic. I think it'll probably become a hotter topic in the coming years because there's serious proposals coming. And it's sort of a question of like obviously you're gonna have regulation on all of these financial systems, but like, is it more of a private-public partnership or is it fully government-controlled? It's kind of the two kind of sides to that debate.
Yeah, no, I think the CBDC idea is so dystopian. I hope at least in its current form it doesn't end up happening. And I think this is a great one to finish on. What requests for new crypto products would you invest in? Or maybe more broadly, like what are the things that you would like to see get built?
Yeah, I mean, so I think, we're like, as an investor, like we do early stage venture capital. We mostly invest in people, so like talented technologists, product designers. And, you know, I found in my career that entrepreneurs are better at coming up with ideas than I am. Mm-hmm. And so I try to keep an open mind and just like hope that someone comes in with an interesting thing. But I do think, as I was mentioning before, like, I think things that kind of counterbalance the consolidation of AI, things that, you know, look, social networking, I talk about it here because it's important. People spend 7 hours a day on the internet and 3 hours or something roughly is in social networks, right? So it's a big category. Gaming's a big category. Gaming is only growing, and then there's sort of metaverse, which is like, I think of as sort of games, you know, this sort of what if games become more than just play, and it's like sort of just you spend more and more of your time in a 3D world. And VR and all these other kinds of things, will, you know, Internet of Things. So there's all these interesting, I think we're entering a really, I as a technology enthusiast, and this is not just blockchain, I think we're entering a really interesting time in the technology world where you kind of have like a number of interesting trends all kind of, you know, coming together. So like the device, Internet of Things, self-driving cars, virtual reality, blockchains, obviously AI. Mm-hmm. You also have the existing trends of just sort of more, you know, mobile phones getting better and computing getting better and getting more immersive, people spending more and more time on these things, the internet getting more and more embedded in the economy and new verticals and categories. So if you're like I kind of think about it like I'm just kind of riffing, but I think about it like, you know, you're born in 1900 and you saw the airplane created, and then you saw, you know, all, of course, two terrible world wars, but then you saw people land on the moon, like in your lifetime, right? And you could kind of argue that maybe, you know, outside of computing, like if you go watch a TV show from 20 years ago or 30 or movies, like phones have changed, computers have changed, but like maybe we've been in this kind of, you know, a little bit otherwise of a technology lull, you know, compared to what someone who born in 1900 might have seen. And my feeling is maybe we're exiting that lull, and like we're about to have, and like this can be good and bad. There's something called future nausea where you're just like overwhelmed with like the changes in the world, and maybe that is some of it. I kind of think like, yeah, I'm ready for it. I'm like, it's going to be fun. Like there's all this crazy new stuff happening. And what tends to happen, like if you think about like last sort of 15 years ago, mobile social cloud was the buzzword, right? And it turned out all three, you know, they were jargon, but they were actually all important. Mobile, you know, obviously is what took computing from 100 million to 5 billion devices. Cloud is the architecture that let you run massive services, and social was sort of the killer app that drove it all. And so they all kind of intersected. So I think, I feel like, and again, I'm just totally speculating here, but I kind of feel like we're entering, and I didn't mention like bio, and like there's just other things I don't know much about, but you've got like these five mega trends, and they're all seem to be accelerating, and they're probably all going to heavily intersect and maybe reinforce each other in various ways. So
what are the five mega trends? Sorry.
Well, I was just saying, I mean, I just was rattling them off, but like, yeah, I think AI, I think VR and sort of VR writ large, like immersive 3D experiences, like I don't know the exact implementation. I mean, whether it's a headset or, you know, I don't know, some eyeglasses or some other thing, or just people spending more and more time in 3D experiences, like devices. So the number of devices in the world is going to is basically think about it like used to be. You know, Bill Gates's expression was a desktop, a computer on every desktop. He said that in the 90s. That sounded crazy. Of course, that was like he underestimated it. Now we have a computer in every pocket. So 5 billion. And if you look at the trend lines, we're headed for 100 billion devices, right? And that's going to be, you know, your AI thing on your thing, your stuff in your car, the Alexa in your home. Like, it's pretty clear we're going to have 100 million devices in the next couple of years, just sort of stuff embedded everywhere in the industrial environments and commercial environments and residential environments, in your car and transportation. Mm-hmm. So IoT, let's call that, VR, blockchain, AI, I guess four. I think bio. I don't know much about bio, but I would expect, because I just have partners who do it, and like they think AI has really transformed it, and you can sort of move from an era of discovery to engineering, and so I don't know. I don't want to even sort of talk about it because I know so little. But anyways, I just think you could be entering this era where all these things are reinforcing. So we invest in entrepreneurs, but I also just really strongly believe in kind of leaning into the future and embracing the future and doing kind of futuristic stuff. And usually when you do that, you know, there's just sort of more, the ball bounces in your direction more often, you know, because something new comes along and you know, kind of gives you wind at your back, so.
Awesome. Well, I think that's an amazing place to end. Looking into this future where all of these amazing new technologies are kind of clashing together. And yeah, we're about to see where that ends. Thanks, everyone, for coming.
Well, if anyone's interested, I'll be signing books at the...
That's right. Chris will be signing books at 4 p.m. in the South by Southwest bookstore. So be sure to go meet him there and get your book signed.
Great. Thank you all.